Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m. right after the WBAI evening news. Stay tuned for Off the Hook coming up. It is almost 7 p.m., and this is still WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
It's been rough for a while, but with COVID for the past 2 years, it's been insane. And we've all, on both sides, been trying to get our points across about how we feel. A 24-year-old basketball player just died in from around where I live, in my district. My district, as you know, is Marjorie Taylor Greene's district. A person who said that, hey, if you're healthy, you'll be fine. 24-year-old played basketball. Dead. 24 years old. He's dead. Otherwise healthy. We need to quit calling people stupid, and we need to figure out a way to do this without screaming and getting mad. But I just don't even know anything other than to say that don't do it because of your politics. Get vaccinated so that you can see your family at Christmas this year. Is that enough? Just do it so you won't be 24 and dead. Just do it so you can live.
Very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined by Kyle.
What?
Just a lot of last-minute things going on here, literally down to the wire. Wow. And let's see. Let's go out into Skype land where somehow it changes my voice. I don't know why it does that. See, I'm in Skype land now, and now I'm leaving Skype land. I'm over here. Why does that happen?
Something's out of phase. Or
maybe
wrong,
if I go to Skype land quickly. Huh? Could you tell I even went to Skype land?
That's okay. A skill. That's a skill.
It's also breaking the board. Okay, well, I see Alex. Alex, it looks like you're in a reality TV show, like you're moving down the hallway or something.
Yeah, good evening, everybody.
And Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
How'd you guys weather the storm? Because last week at this time, there was a storm. We were talking about it, but I don't think any of us realized just how bad it was going to get. And, of course, by bad, I mean good because I love storms, but it was also terrible for the people afflicted. And, boy, there were a lot of people afflicted. You know, usually we drive in to do the show. We haven't done it in over a year, but usually that's what we would do. So we would have been among those people struggling to drive through massive amounts of water. Rob?
Yeah, I caught a little flack after the fact for being the guy who was on the radio last Wednesday saying, oh, it's not raining so hard here in Queens. But
did you really say that? Wow.
I said something like that because at the time it was not. But yeah, we would usually, under normal circumstances, take the subways into the station. And had we done that last week, we would have not been able to do so coming back because the subways were full of water. But we weathered the storm fine here.
It was pretty amazing how everything fell apart so quickly. And yeah, the infrastructure of the subway system, it's been fragile for a while. I've seen floods quite a number of times, never anything like what we've all seen on TV. But it's something you got to maintain. And with climate change, which, by the way, is real, it's quite real, it's going to be a lot more challenging, something that we all have to pay attention to, take seriously, and demand results. Because this kind of thing, it's going to happen again. Now, you know, the record rainfall for 1 hour was set during that Central Park concert, where basically we were saying, hey, New York is back, and Mother Nature said, uh-uh, you're not. and through an hour, in 1 hour, more rain than we had ever seen in Central Park. That was 2 weeks ago. And that record was passed with an inch to spare last Wednesday. So, wow. It's really pretty incredible what is happening. Alex?
Yeah, I don't remember if we spoke about it during overtime or during the actual show, but I was in Pennsylvania last week. I'm in New York at the moment, but we had a huge chunk of a massive tree fall down and just narrowly miss the house. I mean, it literally shook the entire house when it landed, and thank God there wasn't a car or, God forbid, a person underneath that, because both would have been utterly destroyed. I mean, it was the amount of rain together with the wind that was happening in Pennsylvania and the Poconos was just absolutely incredible. I mean, it was an amazing experience to go out in it afterwards, but yeah, it was scary. And then waking up and hearing about these tragedies in Queens, specifically with respect to these poor people that were in basement apartments that were just flooded so quickly. It was absolutely tragic. And I don't understand why it wasn't avoidable. You know, why were these people in these basement apartments not notified or told that they should seek higher ground? I mean, maybe it's a function of climate change and things just being so out of control.
Well, I mean, consider it's rained before, and this hasn't happened before. Not making excuses, but it's unprecedented, and people are going to get things wrong. And dangerous living situations are going to definitely become more dangerous in situations like that. So it's something we just have to keep remembering, learning from. And also keep in mind, this is the same storm that still has much of New Orleans powerless, literally no power. It's just incredible, the wrath of nature. And I think we've done enough to really get nature upset, so expect more. Expect more of this. Hurricane season, we're only midway through it. And there are all kinds of other storms as well that will come our way. Hope our listeners made it through okay. If you noticed anything with technology, infrastructure, the things we talk about week after week here, please write to us, oth@2600.com, with your experiences.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing we're only planning based on our previous experience. And this dynamic storm event, it hits us in places we never really thought were vulnerable, and in unusual and novel ways. So we have to kind of adapt and keep planning for stuff that emerges as a new problem. And this is just, it just shows how small amounts of storm surge and a few feet can hurtle us into a totally unpredictable event like we've experienced.
And what's really interesting about this is that I don't even think Ida was a tropical storm by the time it hit us. It was a hurricane in New Orleans, and it weakened. But you know, we've had hurricanes, we've had tropical storms that have not hit us as hard as whatever this was, which was less than a tropical storm. So it's hard. It's unpredictable. Sometimes you get caught unawares, and that's what happened. I know there was a tweet from I think the National Weather Service or a local chapter of it in New York that said we're issuing a flash flood emergency, and we've never done that before. And that's something so scary about that. When the professionals are in new ground, and you can see the concern, even the fear, in the way they speak, the way they express themselves, and that's when you really have to start taking it seriously. And not unlike what we're seeing with COVID, where the people who know what they're talking about are expressing concern, and we have to respect that. We have to listen. And you know, when you find yourself amongst people who say that NIH and CDC and WHO, they all don't know what they're talking about, and all the doctors and hospitals and all these people, they're all in on the conspiracy. Just stop. Take a step back and listen to yourself. And ask if this is really who you want to be. Because for all of the people who know what they're talking about to somehow conspire just to make things inconvenient for your first grader to wear a damn mask to school or whatever else you think is part of the conspiracy, boy, this is talk about new ground to step on. This has never been accomplished in the history of humanity. It's not what's going on. We're facing a very dramatic health crisis, and vaccine or not, we are all still at risk. You have much lesser risk if you've had the vaccine, but you are still at risk because the disease is not over yet, and there could be more variants that are stronger. Delta is much stronger than the original variant, which I guess doesn't have a name, does it? It's just something that we all need to take seriously. That was Corey Forrester, by the way, up on top of the hour, our friend from Georgia, who usually expresses himself in a much more unerrable way as far as stupidity and culture, especially in the part of Marjorie Taylor Greene land that he is from. And he expresses himself in just such an incredible way. But this was something that I just felt had to be heard by people of New York, because it brings the humanity back into the discussion. And sometimes we forget about that. Alex, you okay? You keep hopping on and off the internet. Are you in some remote location?
Well, I'm in my office. And so I'm actually on my phone using Skype. I don't know if it sounds any different, or maybe it sounds better, because generally mobile phone hardware seems to be better than actual laptop hardware these days.
No, you sound fine. I'm getting a little dizzy looking at you because you're moving constantly, but other than that, the listeners don't care about that. So you're now you're spinning around the room. Thank you for that. That's really nice of you.
This is the the wonders of having a swivel chair.
That's what you're doing. Oh boy.
Yeah.
All right. Well, try to stay connected, because we definitely want to hear what you have to say on many of these issues, including the all-important mandatory 10-digit dialing that will be effective for all kinds of states and area codes on October 24th, 2021. Yeah. You know, I didn't realize the 516 area code, which was stolen from us here on Long Island and given just to Nassau County, they still don't have to dial 10 digits. They can dial 7 digits. If they're calling within the 516, imagine that. If they're calling within the 516 area code, they don't have to dial 516. That used to be the norm. That used to be what everybody would do. Is why would you dial your own area code? You know, as phone freaks, sometimes we would do that because it would route the call through a long distance line instead of a local line, and you could do things like use a red box if it was a payphone, for instance, or maybe you could even seize the trunk with a blue box. There are all kinds of reasons why you might want to do that. But now the reason is because of what I consider to be poor planning, because there's no reason on earth you should have to dial your own area code. I don't think you should have to dial your own exchange, but that's a whole other conversation. Right now what they're doing is they're adding another three-digit code. This three-digit code is 922. 922. I'm sorry. Is it 922 or 988? You know what? I lost a piece of paper that tells me what it is. I thought it was 922. Hang on, I'm looking at it now.
So most people should have been informed about this, and you'll be seeing a lot more attention and and alerts, because things like this aren't just kind of, you know, slipped into the news cycle. This is an official announcement we've unfurled.
Now, okay, so I found it. It's 988, and this just proves, my own confusion proves what a bad system this is. 988 is going to be the National Suicide Prevention and Mental Health Crisis Hotline. So it's a three-digit code, and that's great to have a three-digit code, but as you can see, I got confused. I thought it was 922, but it's 988, and the reason I thought it was 922 was because they're apparently using the dialing the syntax of 9XX, where the X's are the same digit. So 911 is emergency police, and then if they're going 988, that's another kind of emergency, and presumably they're going to fill all the nine repeating digits. England, 999 is how you call the police there. So I don't think it's the best system. I think we have a good system right now. 911, that works. People know how to dial that. What about 811? What about 711? You know, all these numbers that are used for things that not very many people use them for. 811, what's that? For if you're about to dig up a cable, how many people are out there digging up cables? Construction workers mostly, right? I mean, we don't do that. We're not supposed to. So can't you just give a phone number to construction workers so that they call the right number and we can have 811 for maybe, there's an emergency going on here, but keep the cops away. That would be nice. 811 would make sense.
It's not always for contractors, though.
Okay, who else?
Some DIY person or a business that's doing their own digging, you know, they might.
Can't they just call a number? Or they really?
I'm not trying to be contrarian. I just thought, you know, it's not exclusive.
It's not something that happens a lot.
Yeah, not every day. Not as much as people needing that number for something really important.
What's 211 then? Tell me what 211 is. Tell me what 711 is. I know one of them is TTYs for hard of hearing, but I don't know which. 511, what's that? You know, there are plenty of codes that we could use that make more sense than 988. And the reason they have all these mandatory dial your own area code now is because 988 exists as an exchange in many places. If your phone number begins with 988, yeah, what's going to happen? Am I suddenly the suicide hotline now? No, what's going to happen is people can no longer dial you if they don't dial the area code first, because if they dial 988, they're going to get that hotline. You don't have that issue with exchanges that end in 1-1, because there is no 3-1-1 exchange. There is no 9-1-1 exchange. So it's set up to work this way. I just wish they would talk to us first before they did things like this. I wish they would talk to us. They would have talked to us when they started changing area codes. You know, we had a great system where area codes, if there was a 0 in the middle, it meant that it covered the whole state, like 505 was New Mexico, 808 was Hawaii, 907, Rob, was what? Oh, you didn't know I'd be asking questions, did you?
I wasn't aware there'd be a test.
It was Alaska. I'm sorry.
That's Alaska.
Yeah. 207 Maine, yeah, but if it had a 1 in the middle, such as New York, 212, 516, 716, 315, 518, you know, that meant they had multiple area codes in that state. That was a system that made sense. Didn't really need to make sense like that, but it was cool. So when they started just adding three-digit codes as area codes without any kind of regard for if they followed certain rules, it broke the system. Nobody knows what area codes mean anymore. They could have solved the entire thing by adding a digit to phone numbers, you know, making eight-digit phone numbers instead of seven. And would that have been so hard? We'd be dialing eight digits instead of 10 or 11 digits now when we're calling locally. Or, you know, if you really have to expand the area codes, you could have just made them four digits instead of three. There are so many ways they could have done this that would have been better. Alex, you have a point.
Yeah. You know, with respect to the zero or the one in the middle digit of the area codes, I learned something interesting about this, a bit of an aberration with respect to that rule. Are you familiar, Emmanuel, and I'm sure you are, with the 607 area code?
607 is part of New York, isn't it? Rochester, is it? Or is it Syracuse?
Well, it's part of New York that borders Pennsylvania.
Does that have a zero in the middle of it? That's interesting. Was that an expansion area code when they started to run out earlier?
it's very interesting. This one is the aberration or the exception to that rule. 607 was apparently created in 1954 by combining the southern portion of 315 and the eastern portion of 716.
Really?
And it was an exception to that general rule that the zero meant it was the area code for the whole state.
Well, you know, that would have annoyed me then if I had found out about that, because it's breaking the rules. I don't know why they had to do that back then. Were they really expanding that much? And also, were there no ones they could have taken, area codes with ones in the middle that they could have used? You know what? It's water under the bridge. But it reminds me of the interstate system. You know, the interstate system also has rules where basically odd numbers go north and south. So I-95 goes north and south. I-5 on the west coast, north and south. And you might notice that 5 is the bottom of the numbering scheme, furthest to the west, and 95 is at the top, furthest to the east. Now, the same system works east-west, even numbers, I-80, I-90. And again, the further south you go, the lower the number gets. So I-10 is really far south, and I-90 is as far north as you can go. So where the hell is I-99? It's in the middle of Pennsylvania. They put it there for no reason at all. They just broke the rules. I-99 should be on the Atlantic Ocean. It should be as far to the east as you can get. But no, it's in the middle of Pennsylvania. I've asked many construction workers why this is. Nobody knows. Nobody understands it. It's just somebody broke the rules. Somebody didn't care. You know, you have systems. It's like poetry. They just work together, and they make sense in some odd way. But it can all be destroyed just with a few errant numbers.
Then which way does Interstate H-1 go?
You're joking, right? You're talking about Hawaii interstates now? Is that what you're doing? Do they have interstates in Hawaii when they can't possibly? Yeah, it's a joke, but it mocks the entire interstate system. You notice Alaska doesn't have any interstates because they respect the system up there.
I think the original civil engineers and designers have sort of this idea in mind, but after a while, they're not there to really curate it and maintain it, and it's not shepherded through time in quite the way they intended, so it sort of takes different forms and mutates and stuff and becomes something really unrecognizable, like you're pointing out.
And they are twirling in their graves right now, believe me, when they see how their systems are being disrespected like this. All right, moving on, because I'd like to talk about something a bit lighter than this. Montana, we have a lot of listeners in Montana, and the Butte Public Library, is that how you pronounce it? Because I don't want a whole other Spokane thing where I pronounce it the way it's spelled, and I got all kinds of nonsense for that. But B-U-T-T-E, Butte, that's how I'm going to say it. Is someone going to tell me it's butt or what? Am I doing it wrong? Alex?
I think you're right. I think it's Butte.
Okay, let's all agree it's Butte. There's a battle brewing in the computers of the Butte Public Library. It's up to your teens to stop the hackers by becoming hackers. Yeah. Axel Samino is an ethical hacker. Oh, boy. Yeah, the eyes are rolling. I know. And we'll get into why they're rolling in a second. She was a teenager, she had a fascination with the language of computers. My professor was teaching me how to do some coding using QBasic and DOS. Okay, that's cool. You know, nobody does that anymore, but it's kind of neat. This, by the way, comes from KXIF. It intrigued me a lot because my professor said that's the way a computer talks. So by learning a different language, which is DOS, not really, but okay, it kind of gave me the tool to learn how to do HTML, SQL, databases. Now, the ethical hacking class will teach teens the language of computers and how to access a computer's database and to see what vulnerabilities there are. And that's kind of okay, I guess. Now, according to an entity known as EC Council, ethical hacking is the process of detecting vulnerabilities in an application system or organization's infrastructure that an attacker can use to exploit an individual or organization. I think that's what hacking is. I don't think you need to put ethical in front of it to define it that way, because hackers are always looking for things like that.
Yeah, people should focus on being ethical people.
Yeah, ethical people. Now, how would you feel if I said, you know, are you an ethical plumber? You know? I'm looking for an ethical... I'll call the plumber and say, I'm looking for an ethical plumber. What kind of reaction do you think you'll get from the plumber who picks up the phone? You know? Only hacking seems to have this kind of reputation that is bestowed upon it by the media and by elected officials and by the general public. An ethical hacker, also known as a white hat hacker, oh boy, yeah, the eyes are really rolling now because that's a whole other label that just is nonsense and usually is attached to people trying to sell you something, such as classes or certificates or something that proves that you paid the money and can now be classified as quote-unquote ethical, whereas you were not before. Let's see. They are hired by organizations to find faults in their database's security system. They also provide solutions for fixing the vulnerability. In a few words, says Simano, we are going to give the kids tools to fight the hackers. See, this is where I think they're going on the wrong track here. Here's how the situation unfolds. Working against the class is the nefarious company Aquapond that wants to gain access to the library's computers. Aquapond? That's the evil name? That's kind of a nice... I can't believe there's no company, a real company called Aquapond out there that's going to take offense. But, whatever. It's up to the class to stop the fictitious company and hack into their database to get the information to the police. Okay, stop. Full stop. That's not how it works, okay? You don't just hack into a company and then hand over what you find to the cops. There's something called due process. Alex, is it right to be teaching our kids this is how justice is handed out, that you find an evil corporation, you hack into their databases, and then you hand everything over to the cops, and that makes you an ethical hacker?
I would probably advise them a little bit differently. Yeah, I'm not so sure about that. I mean, just look, the whole concept from start to finish is premised on, frankly, erroneous assumptions. So I'd be concerned with the legal advice that they're doling out here.
Well, they say, this is a message to the parents, don't worry, they are not going to do anything illegal or anything like that. We are just giving the tools to the kids to learn how a computer talks. Well, they do a little more than that. First of all, you're besmirching what hackers really are. It's nice that you're teaching what you consider to be ethical hacking, but hacking in by default is ethical. And I think that's the lesson you need to teach to people. Learn how the computer talks, learn the languages and things like that. You're still ethical. You're ethical until you commit a crime, and then you're not ethical. I like to think ethical is a default state. So you don't have to add this adjective to the word, because hacking is an ethical activity, and I think parents should be happy that their kids are learning how to manipulate computers and see what they're saying, what they're doing. Keep in mind this whole lesson where you break into a company called Aquapond that's evil, that's illegal, okay? You stop being ethical when you did that, all right? That's and sometimes, yeah, I know breaking the rules, sometimes breaking the law is an ethical thing, but it's not to be decided in this class. I don't think that's the right message. Rod?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really troubled by the use of the word ethical like this, just because ethical, I feel about it, is it's a neutral term. It's not even necessarily a positive thing. Someone can have a sense of ethics, but their ethics are, I think I should be allowed to murder everybody. You know, that, you know, you can call yourself an ethical this or an ethical that or an ethical hacker, whatever you're doing with it, whether it's responsible, irresponsible, positive, negative, what have you. So I think I find the term ethical hacker just kind of meaningless in itself.
Yeah, just like the hats, like it doesn't need to be described by that. You want to wear yours and treat, I think, the learning process here a lot more like play, like playing with how systems work, understanding the kinds of ways things can break, and exploring more than setting up these sort of confusing stereotypes for kids. I think that's especially bad. We have enough problems with the way hackers are labeled in the adult sphere and in news media and in the way politicians talk about them.
And why is the black hat is the unethical one? You know, who decides these things? Who says white hat good, black hat bad, and gray hat somewhere in the middle? No, it's fostering stereotypes. It's creating new stereotypes. I wear a black hat, doesn't make me a bad person. All right? My actions are what make me a bad person. I came out wrong. My actions are what could make me a bad person if they were bad actions, is what I'm trying to say. And that is how we should all be judged, not by our interests, not by the fact that we like to hack into things or hack a hardware or software or just think creatively. What other field can you attach that to? You know, ethical doctors, ethical lawyers. I mean, Alex, how would you feel if you had to put the word ethical in front of your title? Because so many lawyers were lawyer by default is not considered ethical. And I know there are people that believe that, but I don't believe that, and I'm sure most people don't.
You know, it's interesting. Obviously, there is a full canon of ethics to which lawyers must abide, you know, at all times. But there is something akin to an ethical certification for attorneys around the country. Before you even take the bar exam, you have to take something called the MPRE, which is the Multi-State Professional Responsibility Exam, and you cannot be admitted to the bar if you fail that. And that's basically a test of your knowledge and application of the ethical standards to which attorneys must abide at all times. And so there is this concept of being a certified ethical attorney as well.
Well, you pass a test, but they don't put the word ethical in front of your your name on the door.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, you pass a test, but you don't have the that attached to your name, or it would seem just absolutely silly and redundant. I mean,
we could do the same thing in the hacker world. We could have a test, but the problem with that is that hacking is so widespread in so many different fields that somebody could be an expert programmer and not know the first thing about phones, and vice versa. There are so many things that you could be good at and so many things you could be bad at, and nobody knows everything. So I'm not a programmer. People think I am because I'm in the hacker world, but no, you don't have to be a programmer. I can break programs, I can make them stop working, I can usually find bugs, but everyone has their own skill set in one form or another, and there are people who might simply be able to hack game systems and can't find their way around the Macintosh. It doesn't make them any less of a hacker. So you can't really have a test that will prove you're a hacker or not. What you can do is simply say, you know, are you stealing? Are you ripping people off? If so, then you're unethical. And you might be a hacker too. Who knows? It doesn't really matter. You're a thief, you know, because that is something else entirely. Or you are an ethical person. Maybe you're a hacker who's ethical. Maybe you're somebody else who's ethical. But these are different concepts, and it doesn't really tie into what a hacker by default is. Rob?
And the fact that you need to take a test and be certified as an ethical hacker to get one of these certificates is kind of funny because, like, I think the hacker mindset drives someone to, whether or not they have what you might consider to be a positive set of ethics, a hacker sitting in front of that test would be like, okay, I know which answers to put in to get what I want, to get the answers that they want me to have and earn the certificate, whether or not they're, you know, ethical people as you might describe them.
So wait, if you cheat to get the ethical hacking title, did you cancel yourself out, or are you double ethical? Or, I don't know, there's a whole other word for that, I guess. But I think it makes you more of a hacker. Yes, Alex?
I mean, this is something I think we've talked about in the past, too, and I've said, I feel like, numerous times to various people over the last couple of weeks, and it's something that you hit on, too, Emmanuel, which is being a hacker. To me, and this has always been my outlook on it, is less about technical skills and more about having a certain mindset, perhaps even a certain sort of philosophical outlook akin to, and I don't mean this in a derogatory manner, but maintaining a childlike attitude towards the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because being a hacker is about being unafraid to take things apart. It's about being unafraid to ask questions. And frankly, it's about being unafraid to be wrong. Because being wrong is part of that learning process. And being a hacker is about learning systems. It's about learning these processes and finding the vulnerabilities in those systems and those processes. And it's for that reason that I really believe that the best lawyers out there have this type of mindset. And therefore, the best lawyers are hackers, even though they might not know it. Or frankly, they might not admit it because of all of the ethical negative connotations about the term.
Go ahead, Rob.
And, you know, putting aside for the moment the goofy terminology around this, I do think it's really great that people are considering teaching these sorts of concepts and things to kids, because that, you know, I know it's true for myself. I know it's true for so many in this community that they first caught, you know, sort of the hacker bug as a kid when they were exploring the world, figuring the world out, how things around them worked. And I think it's, like you said, it's a very childlike thing to have that curiosity about the things around you and want to learn more about them. And, yeah, there's nothing wrong with being childlike because that's what children do. They learn. So I know I encourage the children in my life, you know, friends, family, whatever, to nurture those sorts of hackery instincts. And I think it's great that, like, if you watch the old movie The Breakfast Club, it starts with these panning shots of the high school computer room and other classrooms and stuff. And on the wall of the computer room is a sign that says "Hackers will be expelled." And I used to have that as my desktop image for a while, but it shows that the attitudes toward what you might call a hacker in schools have changed. Because I remember when we were basically having to keep our interests secret from our teachers, from our people who were supposed to be educating us, because you know, if anyone heard you're a hacker, that's terrible. But it's great that we can encourage the hacker mindset in kids now.
I think there's maybe there's a lack of stories or curricula to complement this kind of lesson plan, and maybe this was a sanitized attempt to make it sort of palatable to a school because it's good guys, you know, it's so black and white, good guys and bad guys, because, you know, the old cops and robbers paradigm, which is silly. And I think there's so many other ideas and stories that could show just as much of that hacker curiosity, et cetera, that we've been talking about.
I think they have good intentions. I'm not shooting down this whole thing going on in the Butte public library system. And by the way, kudos for having a Butte public library system.
When you first said this headline, I thought it was the students were being encouraged to help them with some kind of ransomware or something that went wrong.
Which they could do. They could absolutely do that. You know, so this, what Alex refers to as the childlike mentality, yeah, that is an asset. That is a good thing. That's something we could use more of in our daily lives. That sense of wonder, and discovery, and just looking at the world as something that is overall a positive place. You look at kids in many parts of the world, and they always seem so happy, even if they're going through miserable conditions. You know, a lot of them are just smiling, and you can't figure out why sometimes. But if you remember that childlike innocence that we all once had, that's very much something that I think is valued in the hacker community. Plus, you get to drive when you're older. So if you can keep both of those things, wow, there's all sorts of things you can accomplish. But staying on this topic for a moment, and by the way, if you want to join the conversation, you can. But you have to wait till 8 o'clock when we go on to YouTube. In fact, let me give you the phone number now so that you don't have to write it down then. 802-321-HACK is our phone number. Don't call it now. You won't get anything. 802-321-4225. And that will enable you to call in and talk with us, which we can't do on the radio now since we're remote, but we can do that over the Internet later on. But if you remember last year, there was this guy named John Paul McIsaac. He was the owner of a computer repair shop, and his name became kind of famous after the New York Post ran a story regarding what was apparently Hunter Biden's laptop that had been abandoned at his shop and that eventually found its way into the hands of Rudy Giuliani. And the story just kind of took on a life of its own at that point. We awarded him Hacker of the Week because this guy got so upset at the way the story was being categorized. He accused Twitter of labeling him a hacker. And he thought the term was so derogatory that it was destroying his life, even though Twitter never did any such thing. Basically, the concept of hacking was brought up. He still filed the lawsuit. And I believe, Alex, correct me if I'm wrong, that lawsuit was dismissed the same day it was filed, which is something that doesn't happen very often.
I don't recall if it was dismissed the same day it was filed, but I believe it's possible.
Yeah, it was. I'm looking at the story now. The initial lawsuit was tossed the same day it was filed on jurisdictional grounds. But what they did was, what he did, he filed a similar lawsuit a couple of months later that added something called MadBits as a defendant. Now, MadBits was an image search startup that Twitter acquired many years ago and shut down. Now, what he argues in the complaint is that MadBits still exists, even though Florida records show the company was shut down after the acquisition. He said they still existed as a way for Twitter to somehow skirt Florida employment laws, but either way, the addition of MadBits provided the kind of diversity jurisdiction necessary to keep the case alive, unlike the initial version that got tossed. These are some legal gymnastics that I guess they're worthy of recognition. Right, Alex?
Yeah. Diversity there refers to a legal term of art. And what it means is that on both sides of the V of the lawsuit, for the plaintiff and the defendant, they have to reside in different states in order to have federal jurisdiction. That's one way of getting into federal court, is to have diversity jurisdiction. The other way is to have federal question jurisdiction, and that means that the lawsuit arises under federal law or raises a constitutional issue. But diversity is a great way to get your case into federal court, and it's premised on this notion that arose in the 18th century when we're creating, you know, these Article III courts, is that the state courts of one state would favor its own citizens as opposed to the citizens of another state. So that if a resident of New Jersey was suing a resident of New York, they should be allowed to use the federal courts of the United States of America to settle those disputes rather than the state courts. So that's how he was trying to hold on to federal jurisdiction by adding this party that was outside of his home state.
Well, so basically this all stemmed from the fact that Twitter made the decision to block the story, which was a mistake, and they corrected that afterwards, but it really was a bad precedent they were trying to set there. Basically, they said that this New York Post story relied on hacked materials, therefore, they wouldn't allow links to the New York Post story. That's way overreaching what Twitter is supposed to be about. But this guy, he saw that, hacked materials, and he was the person who provided the laptop to Giuliani. He thought that somehow made him labeled a hacker. And he thought the term was so derogatory that he went on this campaign to bring Twitter down for daring to accuse him of being somehow related to hackers. See, this is what happens when you have this whole ethical hacking nonsense. This is how people view the hacker community. Anyway, so he brought MadBits up, thinking that would somehow help. It didn't. According to this TechDirt article, Florida's anti-slap law now means that he is on the hook for Twitter's legal fees. Yeah, the ruling is pretty straightforward. This was not anything even remotely close to defamation. Regarding the defamation per se claims, the judge notes that his legal theory is flawed for several reasons, mainly because nothing Twitter did was in reference to Isaac himself, the guy that was filing the lawsuit. So, yeah, it's rare to see justice come out of Florida, but in this particular case, I think it prevailed. Who knows if there'll be another lawsuit, but I think now he's on the hook for a lot of legal fees.
Yeah, and it's worth noting, too, that that slap suit, I mean, that's usually used by smaller entities against a bigger entity, not necessarily the other way around. So this is an unusual outcome here. So SLAP stands for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation, and that's, in essence, a law that allows you to reverse the fees when a lawsuit is filed to censor or intimidate or, in essence, silence critics by burdening them with the cost of a legal defense until they, let's say, they relinquish their criticism or they stop speaking about a particular issue because the costs of litigation are just too high. So those are generally what slap suits are, and those are usually wielded by little guys against big guys, not the other way around, as it is in this case.
Wow. Here's another legal case that I think is rather interesting to focus on. But apparently AI systems, artificial intelligence systems, cannot be granted patents and will not be recognized as inventors in the eyes of the U.S. law. That's according to a federal judge who decided to uphold a previous ruling by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office this week. I didn't know this was even a conversation. Stephen Thaler, who is the founder of Imagination Engines, a company in Missouri, applied in 2019 for two U.S. patents describing a food container based on fractal geometry and an emergency light beacon. Yeah, you think we're geeks. This is the kind of thing that's going on in the real world here. Yeah. Instead of putting his own name on the applications, Thaler gave all credit to Dabas, which was an evil robot in Star Trek. No, it's not. It's a neural network he built and claimed came up with both creations. I don't know how the network came up with the creations, but whatever. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, however, rejected both applications and said only natural persons are allowed to be named as an inventor on the patent paperwork. Thaler, in response, sued the director of the patent office at the time. This guy sounds like a lot of fun to hang out with. So he sued the patent office to challenge that decision. There is no statute or case that has found an AI-generated invention cannot be patented or that holds an AI cannot be listed as an inventor, his lawyers argued. Rather, any discussion of inventors as natural persons has been based on the assumption that only a person could invent or to prevent corporate and sovereign inventorship at the expense of a human inventor. But it sounds like me arguing with some anti-vax people right now. It's basically, and of course, I'll bet natural people made this rule in the first place, so that makes it doubly invalid. Judge Leone Brinkema disagreed, sided with the patent office's current director, because the other one just, I guess, quit, ruling that the law states individuals must take an oath to swear they are the inventor on a patent application. These individuals must be natural persons, which computer software is not. And, okay, it's 2021, and we've reached the conclusion that computer software is not human. I'm kind of glad about that. But, Alex, what's your perspective on this rather interesting case?
I mean, I think it certainly makes sense that you can't program something to make additional inventions and then have that be the owner. I mean, it just seems as if it's a pretty common sense decision that makes a distinction between a natural person and a thing.
Yeah, but do you remember that episode of Star Trek where Data created an android? All right, now who created the android then? You know? So are you going to take that away from him? Yeah.
Well, no, I think algorithms and AI can certainly create other things. That's certainly the case, but they will not have the patent rights that belong to natural persons, associated with them. And I think that's an important distinction here. I mean, I think it certainly does make sense from an intellectual property standpoint to have ownership of IP belong to other types of AI or other types of algorithms seems really strange. You would probably have to have some other subclass of IP developed, and maybe there will be an additional class of intellectual property that's developed to address these particular situations, over the next several years. But yet, on the other hand, everything boils down to this notion of a legal fiction of personhood. Because what is a corporation except not, you know, a fictitious person that can own certain types of intellectual property as well?
Rob?
There's a great case, and it is intellectual property, which means that that necessitates having some sort of intellect to have this property. And at present, I don't think computers legally have an intellect. There was a case going way back where a nature photographer went to the jungle to take pictures of monkeys, left some equipment on the ground, and the monkeys ended up playing with the cameras and inadvertently snapping photos of themselves. And these went viral as the monkey selfies. And it's a great case. You can look it up. And what ended up happening, this went through the courts because the guy asserted that he had ownership of the images because it was his camera, even though he didn't physically take the photos. PETA, I think, got involved in the lawsuit saying, no, the monkey should own the photos and therefore be the owner. And basically the ruling of the courts was, no, nobody owns these because the animal took the photos and the animal is not a person in terms of intellectual property ownership, so they're public domain.
And the animal is also not artificial, so that adds more complexity to it.
Absolutely. But, like, you know, if an animal is not a person for purposes of intellectual property, I don't think a computer program that is programmed to guess at things can be an intellectual property owner either.
Kyle?
I think this is a really interesting area. Alex's points about corporations being persons, I mean, what does the patent office really mean by natural persons? I mean, it is specific and probably a legal term, but it really makes you wonder, especially when you apply it to things less sort of mundane as like a food container. I think when you look at practical uses of this that are that have a big impact and that are high stakes, like in chemistry and in medicine, the kinds of molecules and things that are being discovered often are the product of systems like this. So it's certainly not unusual to be using computers to find new ways of structuring things in an engineering sense or in biochemical or pharmaceutical uses. There's a lot of things, especially even human DNA and other aspects of it. So it's certainly something we should watch and think about carefully.
We're going to continue this conversation over on YouTube. Go to www.2600.com/channel2600. Actually, I'm sorry. No, I got that wrong. YouTube.com/channel2600. Or follow the link that's on the 2600.com webpage, and you can call us and continue the conversation. Alex, I just wanted to ask you one quick question in 15 seconds. Natural person. Okay, so are they saying that the AI is a person and it's just not natural? What word is applies to them?
I think it's that it's both, right? A natural person is a real person. You know, and perhaps this really gets to a philosophical concept, right? That, you know, it has to be an individual with consciousness that develops a particular thing for which a patent can be granted. And, you know, as Rob aptly noted, you know, we're not there yet. There's a difference between, as John Searle, the philosopher, would say, the simulation and the duplication of consciousness.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there or pick it up in a few minutes on YouTube/channel2600. Keep tuned to WBAI. We'll be back again next week. Good night. Uh-oh.
Yo! Yo! Hey, yo! Check it out. Here it comes.
There's something right, yo.
Watch out, man. Look at that boom. It's packing. Here it comes.
Yo.
Yo, Tuck, come on. Yo, Omar, I'm coming, man.
Mm. Yeah, the cheese stands alone.
When you walk through the garden, watch your back. Well, I beg you, pardon, walk the straight and narrow track. If you are the Jesus, save your soul. Gotta keep the devil down in the room. He's got fire and the fury.